do have time for questions. Would you like me to chair the questions, or will you? The floor is open for comments, questions, anything that you would like to contribute.
Free associations.
Free associations. Fantasies. Please. Would you mind introducing yourself?
All right. I'm Lisa Gallagher. I'm in the philosophy department at TIGCT. I was just wondering whether you would apply the picture that you've given of the kind of excess of death drive, if you like, to Zionism and the Israeli state. Whether you think that picture would also apply to the self-image of Palestinians, which, where, for example, suicide bombing is carried out regularly. The notion of the victimhood is also seen as a way of justifying acts of terrorism. And if so, whether you think, in that respect, both Palestinians and Israelis share the sort of same sense of themselves as victims. So it's not just on one side, whether you think they can have a shared dialogue.
I think it's very different. First of all, the Palestinians don't have a state, and they don't have a nation. So if we're talking about state power, we can't talk about Palestinians in the same way. Where I do agree with you is that there are victim narratives of victimhood on both sides. And it was absolutely central to Edward Said's work, as I understand it, that the affirmation of nationalism on the part of the Palestinian people should be a very different form of affirmation than Israeli nationalism. Indeed, I think the most nationalisms we've ever seen, let's say it had to be contrapuntal, fragmented, hesitant, diasporic, exilic, all had to be internalized into the national narrative. That's why Said's work on, famous essay on Freud and the non-European was so important. When you took from Freud the idea that Moses was an Egyptian and said we need a people who are founded on the other, so it will be a different form of national identity. The jury's out on that, because the Palestinians, although they have a strong national identity, they don't yet have state power. And the question is what that power will look like and what they will do with it. So, for example, the extraordinary Palestinian filmmaker Elias Suleiman, Divine Intervention, some people know his film, and his recent film is about 1948. When somebody in the audience, when he showed that film, said something about we as the Palestinians, he said, I've got two things to say. One, I don't want to hear a we in that way, because he thinks it's dangerous. He said, I'm fighting for a Palestinian flag. The moment we get it, I'll be fighting to pull it down. That is to say, we've got to be very, very careful. So I think there's a consciousness inside certain forms of thinking, inside Palestinian critical thought, about precisely trying to avoid what you've described. Suicide bombing and death, I think that's very complex. I mean, I'm very opposed to the argument that this shows they have a culture of death. They don't call them suicide bombings, they call them martyrdom. I'm very interested in why we think that shows more of a culture of bombing than Bomber Harris bombing people from the air. Why, if you kill yourself at the same time, somehow that seemed to be worse. I think they're very, very, and basically the thing you have to talk about is the disparity of power between the two sides. So I understand what you're saying, and where I definitely agree with you is that the moment victimhood becomes an identity, something has gone seriously wrong. And of course there are possibilities of that in Palestinian thinking, of course, as well. But all the Palestinian figures, like someone like Elias Khoury's Gate of the Sun, I mean, it couldn't be more a critique of that. It's the first mammoth epic of 1948. He's Lebanese, and he said, I always said we need an epic of 1948. I never thought I'd be the one to write it. It's an incredible novel. And, you know, I think it's the best answer to your question. It's so not doing that. But it sees it as a problem, as a potential problem.
Yeah, my question arises probably from the last one. And there's another part to it. Because so you're trying to apply sort of psychoanalytic ideas to a nation or a people rather than just to an individual. And so I was wondering whether there are sort of some preconditions which a community has to satisfy before you think that it's acceptable to do that. Like what has to bind a group of people together for it to be legitimate to apply sort of psychoanalytic thought. And then it arises from Elisa's question, actually, because sort of surprised me that you see such a central criterion in the state, because
two really interesting questions. Let me start with the second one. It was crucial to Zionism that it become a nation state. And it was crucial to Zionism that that concept of national, so that the Jews would cease to be a stateless persons, right? So there's the notion of nationhood and statehood became inextricably bonded in Zionist thought. So I don't think you can separate them out. And what's interesting is if you read some of the critics of Zionism, who also define themselves as Zionists, like Martin Buber, not just Hannah Arendt, Martin Buber, he wanted there to be a kind of national belonging of Jews in Palestine, which would not become a nation state, because he saw that as the problem. So I think your question is important insofar as there were things you precisely wanted to hold the distinction apart, but it became impossible to do so for historically necessary reasons. I mean, you know, the Jews could not go on being a stateless person for people after what had happened. But your first question, if I can go back to it, what does a group have to fulfill in order to be available to psychoanalytic thought? I don't like the word apply, by the way. I hate the word apply because it makes psychoanalysis like a master discourse and I'm going to apply myself to yours. I don't like that. But what, I mean, I think the way I would answer that question is that psychoanalysis from the beginning was deeply involved in the idea of what constitutes the social reality of the human subject. Because, you know, if you just take Winnicott, there's no such thing as a baby. I.e., there's a mother and a baby. Or you take Lacan's mirror phase, which is the baby looking at itself in the mirror, and then he said, no, I got this completely wrong. There's never just a mother and a baby. There's never just the baby in its image. There's the baby looking for social recognition from the mother, right? Okay, which means that you're already in a social structure. Or you take the Oedipal complex, which is a group of three. But even more than that, half of Freud's work or more, certainly after 1914, was about social, cultural, and political life. Civilized sexual morality, that's early civilized sexual morality, modern nervous illness, but civilization's discontents, thought for the times of war and death, future of illusion, group psychology, Mosin monotheism. He doesn't stop. And there's a wonderful critic who has pointed out that it's when Freud theorizes narcissism, which is to do with the subject's most intimate relationship to themselves, that he also starts to become preoccupied with the social relation between the subject and the other. They happen together in his thought. But the more simple answer to your question would be to refer to the work of Beale, who was this extraordinary psychoanalyst who sort of, I mean, there are other people who say a lot more about this than I can in this room, sitting sort of over there somewhere. okay, who after Freud's group psychology, wrote his own essay in the 50s called Group Psychology, A Review, where he talked about how groups work. And he also says an individual is a group at war, i.e. that inside your mind, you're a group. You're never just one person. So I don't quite accept the distinction between individual psychology and group psychology, but it would be a whole other conversation. So I appreciate the question.
There were three hands, one right at the back, and then to the front, and then to Professor Nash.
Thank you, I enjoyed it very much. My name is
Can you speak up a little bit? I'm so sorry.
Sorry. My name's Hanwar. You spoke about Israel's success as a state. There's been a trend which I picked up in our local newspapers amongst correspondents about the Israel-Palestinian issue, in which Israel talks of its success, and people talk of Israelis or people of Israeli origin or Jewish origin who have achieved a lot and have, in proportion, a very high number. And I wondered whether that stems in your second point about a sort of similarity with apartheid thinking, where people said that different races were different and that black people were inferior. And this strengthens the Israeli argument that we can't live with these people because look how well we've done and look how they live. They just live absolutely in an old tradition.
Yeah, well, two things I want to say about that. There was the Minister of Education who famously said, you know, if Palestinians had been a people, they would have had a literature. And Golda Meir famously said, there is no such thing as Palestinian people. And Emil Habibi wrote his wonderful novel, Side the Pessoptimist, more or less as a kind of, you say we're not okay, I'm going to show you, right? I'm going to write this novel. I mean, this is just to show you that we are a people. So that argument that the Palestinians are not a people, and also if you think about the amazing work of the West Eastern Divan Orchestra with Edward Said and Daniel Barenboim, you know, it started, you know, the joke, you know, no Arab is going to be able to play Beethoven or Mozart. I mean, that begs the question of whether they shouldn't also be playing Arabic music, right? But still, it was partly as a rejoinder to that. So yes, I think that idea, I mean, look how many Nobel laureates we have and everything, which means we're superior people, there's no doubt. Oh, and the Arabs are liars, that's the other one that Barak has said, you know, we can't trust them, they're liars. I mean, some of the racist stuff that comes out is really abysmal, right, you know, without question. But in relationship to a successful state, when you were saying that, I thought you were actually going to pick me up on a contradiction in this paper, which I only noticed as I was delivering it, which is that when I quote Ebba Said saying, you know, Zionism has been a success, it's been a wonderful thing for the Jewish people, well, it's created the national self-determination of the Jewish people. But my Jewish friends say to me, my Israeli friends say to me, I'm Jewish, my Israeli friends say to me, you know, there's nowhere less safe in the world for a Jew than Israel. It's become the most terrifying place to be. So to that extent, you know, when Doron Rosenblum says, is this all we are, the victim of the Shoah? Is that all we are? Then Israel has failed as a nation. And in fact, I'm just remembering I got into a quite heady exchange with Edward Luttwak, where I ended a paragraph of a review about a David Grossman novel about all the dead coming back and everybody falling apart. And I said, Israel is a failed state. And I sometimes write for London Review of Books, you never tell them what you want. You wait to see what they're going to give your essay as a title. It's one of the best things about writing for them. What are they going to call this? This time I said, I want you to call this article failed state. Please do it, right? Okay, so they call it failed state, and sure enough, you know, in comes the correspondence. And I said, and the correspondence was, what about all the Nobel laureates? What about all these wonderful people? I said, excuse me, you know, David Grossman, the Shin Bet leader, they're all saying Israel is destroying itself. These critiques are coming out from inside the city and inside the nation. So I think Nisa, you know, Ebba Said has been a wonderful thing. I think he's got it all in quotation marks. But of course it has been a source of pride to many Jewish people that Israel created itself. I mean, of course, heroic conduct. That's when the questions have to begin for me.
English department,
sorry? English
department.
English, okay.
Okay,
you hear me?
Yeah, just about. Now, I just wanted to put a thought to you that occurred to me as you were speaking very vividly. I'm not sure what it's worth, but it just came up. It's really about the relation of Europe and, I guess, the West to Zionism and the situation. You talked about the necessity of thinking Zionism historically. You mentioned in the same essay, Zionism from the standpoint of its victims. About Daniel Deronda, George Eliot's novel Daniel Deronda. And it's fascinating to me that both you and Said should write about that book so early in your intellectual career. And it's one I've also been working on for many years, and I understand it less and less.
I couldn't agree with you.
But it just occurs to me that book is in some way a presentiment of silence.
It is or it isn't?
Or in some way a presentiment of the idea of the state of Israel. And some years later, Herzl will recognize in some uncanny way something in that book that preceded it. But it's profoundly also about a fracture in British identity or English identity. That is, it's an English writer recognizing difference within an English national imagining. So it produces Jewish figures and the idea of a project of Israel. And even perhaps the Dreyfus of it is the recognition in France of that France is internally fractured, internally differentiated. And the Jewish figures become visible, I guess, as a consequence of that. But thinking of Said's critique of Daniel Deronda, my question is really this. Why does it seem to me that the European recognition of national fracture produces whole Jews and invisible Palestinians?
I think that was an essay. It's your next book, right? And I think you've answered it better than I can. I think I slightly disagree with Ebba Said's reading of Daniel Deronda, which is it isn't a presentiment of Zionism. I've had this argument with students actually when I say this, because I think she's closer to Ahad Ha'am. I think when she says revive the organic center, and when she says, you know, the yearning for Zion, I think she's closer to cultural Zionism than political Zionism. I think she's close to the Zionism that wants Palestine to be an organic spiritual center for the rebirth of Jewishness as a counter to the corruption of European culture. Right. I don't think she's talking about a nation state in the way that whoever it was who asked me the question about, does it have to be a nation state? Although I can't, we'd have to have the book here, which would really bore everybody else. But anyway, we'd have to have the book here. But there is one sentence where I know when I've said this to students, they say, yeah, well, what about this sentence? I think Sai is right. I think she wants a state. But if you read something like The Modern Hep Hep Hep, she does talk about the need for national belonging, unequivocally. But then she surrounds the necessity of statehood and nationhood with lots of perhapses and maybes, and I think she really doesn't know which way to jump. And so therefore, and because for me, what is important is to catch moments of people who are about to jump the wrong way when they could have jumped the other way. I don't want to put her on the side of political Zionism, because it's in those moments of fracture that I see the hope. Now, in relationship to the question of what Europe does to the Jew, well, it does two things. It sends them off to Palestine to found a nation, and it sends them to Devil's Island. And it's as if those are the alternatives, because you mentioned Dreyfus. Those are the alternatives. There's no way to be a Jew in Europe. I mean, this is one of the great parodies of Zionism, which, you know, Yitzhak Lauer, the wonderful radical commentator, he says, you know, Herzl wanted to be a European. The Jews could not be Europeans in Europe. They were the Semitic other. The only way they could be Europeans was going to the Middle East and finding a different Semitic other called the Arabs. So in a sense, the fantasy of Zion was always, for the Jew, a European fantasy. And that's why the Hebrew was spoken with a strong German accent at the beginning. So Europe and Zion is very, very complicated. I think we need proofs, but we're not going to go there.
My question concerns an area of blindness to that which is in open sight, which I don't think you've mentioned in the lecture. Thank you also, it's a fascinating lecture. And that concerns the long history, 1,000 years and more, of coexistence of Jews and Muslims in the Eastern Mediterranean region, which...
And in Spain.
Specifically since the 1967 war, has been increasingly rewritten as a history of... a history primarily of Jewish persecution, and sort of small details like the caliph welcoming Jews back into Jerusalem, the Arab conquests, or Saladin welcoming Jews and, actually as it happens, Eastern Christians back after the Crusaders had to come. Those get lost from sight. The Ottoman Empire welcoming Spanish Jews expelled from Spain into their cities. And it seems, I suppose my question is that legacy still important? Is there still, I mean, which dates back to Jews as a major part of Alexandria, long before the rise of Islam? It's something which is often also, I think, lost from sight in political theories of multiculturalism and cosmopolitanism and so on, which treat it as something which began when the Canadians declared Multicultural Day in the public holiday in 1971. If I can just make one comment briefly, it's often said by Palestinians in South Africa and the Palestine Solidarity Movement that South Africa is important to them. But I think the reverse is also true, that Palestine is important to South Africa in the sense that if people who live together had that much in common, that closely integrated life for so many centuries, cannot find a way of living together within a common society, then what chance is there of a society like South Africa actually overcoming its legacies of racial belief?
Well, you realize that the two halves of what you said almost cancel each other out, because on the one hand you're appealing to a form of multi, in the best sense of it, on the one hand you're appealing to a form of multiculturalism for which the model would be, say, Seville. You know, or would be the Jews under the Ottomans. It's always worth pointing out that the Jews did so much better under the Ottomans than they did in the heart of Europe. I mean, I think you really have to say that. But I know there are people who are, I mean, not just the West Eastern Divan. I go to Seville every year and to say, look, this is the place where Muslims, Christians, and Jews work together. But there are people who are thinking of binationalism as some form of federated future, which I'm not saying necessarily is going to happen. in terms of a kind of cultural connectedness between the different peoples. Weizmann, the first president of Israel, said they are, after all, our cousins. I mean, they are both the Jews and the Arab Semitic peoples. So there's a particular tragedy, which I think Freud will put under the title of the narcissism of minor differences. Okay, but in a way, you might say, I mean, the second part of your question then is about whether the legacy of hatred is going to be too powerful to allow that other model of what cohabitation and coexistence could be. And all I can say is the jury is out on that. But in relationship to the comparison you're making, in a way, it's maybe worse when the peoples feel they are actually the same. That there's a kind of a form of hatred that I think takes root when that's the case, which I think is rather different than when people can say, we really are different, but we've got to be just. I think the internal demands that are made by those two histories are different. And of course, there are other distinctions. I mean, I was just reading Saul Duvaux's extraordinary brief history of human rights in South Africa, and there was two moments that really stood out for me. And one was when he said the ANC demanded full citizenship on the basis that they too were subjects of the king. I don't think any Palestinian is going to come up with any equivalent statement. And the other one was when Luthuli said in 1968, the 20th anniversary of the UN Declaration of Human Rights, he said, South Africa is the only nation in the world that is, as a matter of policy, violating the precepts of the International Declaration of Human Rights. It was a year after the 67 war. Right? You can't see it. Right? You can't see the connection. Which is not to say that many people aren't working across the barrier. I don't have an answer. I've waffled because I really don't have an answer to your really important. I think the jury's out.
Can you manage one more question?
Yes, sure.
If there's one more.
Thanks very much. I was really struck by your formulation of splitting at the beginning. And you touched very briefly on it a moment ago, talking about high nationalism. And I was wondering if you might formulate a kind of notion of the sort of psychic charge of one-state solution. If one proceeds with a kind of psychoanalysis of, I love your formulation of it, curled within itself, this kind of death drive, then what then, how then should we think about this kind of cohabitation? Maybe we redress that in this answer.
I think one has to be very, very practical at the moment. Then the two-state solution has been destroyed more or less definitively, I think. So I think there's going to be a binational solution by default, which Gideon Levy, the extraordinary campaigning Haaretz journalist, says will be an apartheid state based on the sort of indentured labor of the Palestinians and an increase of inequality between the Palestinians and the Jewish citizens of Israel. That is not the binationalism of a country of all its citizens that is the ideal of binationalism. I mean, that is really it is the overwhelming difference of coming here when I've been working on that other conflict for so, and thinking about I know things are really difficult here still, and in many ways, I mean, I'm not idealizing it, but something epoch-making happened here, and there is no sign of that transformation happening in Israel. For reasons we know, it'd be another very long conversation to have, which I'd love to have with a number of you, but no sign at the moment of what I think you rightly, and behind your question, there's an ideal there, but I think remembering that can be transformed. So I think that's important.
We have wine and snacks outside for a little bit. I'd like to extend my thanks to Mark Soames from the Department of Psychology, who was very instrumental in making this possible, and also thank the staff of the African Gender Institute, who helped along in setting this up. But my most